In the new book, There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century, foreign policy expert and key impeachment witness Fiona Hill reveals how declining opportunity has set America on the grim path of modern Russia, and draws on her personal journey out of poverty, as well as her unique perspective as an historian and policymaker, to show how we can return hope to our forgotten places. Fiona Hill is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. From 2017 to 2019, she served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council. Her new book is There Is Nothing For You Here, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Fiona Hill to the roundtable this morning. Fiona, thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate you being here.
Oh, thanks, Joe. Really good to be with you today. Thank you.
Assuming what happened to you hadn't happened to you, would there still be a book?
Well, it depends on which bit of the bit that happened to me.
Let's say the impeachment part of it.
I mean, when Trump was first elected in 2016, before there was any inkling that I would get approached to go into the administration, you know, there'd been a kind of lot of shock and consternation around the halls of the Brookings Institution where I worked. You know, people hadn't seen this coming. There'd been a similar reaction to Brexit in the UK just a bit earlier in the year, in the summer of 2016, when, you know, the largest of the British population, unexpectedly from the point of view of the British government and many other observers, voted to leave the European Union. And I'd seen that one coming from a mile off, based on where I lived and all the interactions of my family. And similarly with Trump in 2016, you know, based on my own interactions with family members, extended family members in the United States, as well as just my own observations. And I was a bit perplexed as to why people hadn't seen these two phenomena linked together, and why, you know, they'd kind of totally misread the political moods in both countries. Because to me it seemed, you know, fairly obvious. And I had thought about at the time about writing something about it. And then the next thing is I found myself being asked to enter the administration, the Trump administration, on the basis of my own expertise as a Russia analyst, someone who'd worked in the government before as a national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia. It was on that basis that people were approaching me. I wanted to do something to push back against the Russian interference operations, big effort that the Russian security services had launched against us in threatening our democracy and trying to upend the whole faith of Americans in the electoral system. So, you know, that was the mission that I had in mind. But as I went through my experience in the National Security Council, seeing Trump up close, and then also then finding myself being embroiled in the first impeachment trial, it became obvious that things that I had observed earlier were now in full fruition. And, you know, when I came out of the other end of the administration, especially after that experience testifying before Congress, I was very much determined to write this book. Now, the way that I've written it is probably a little bit unusual, but absolutely, you know, that was the crystallization in those experiences 2 years ago this month in October of 2019, and the depositions, and then later in November of 2019, the public testimony. That was the moment when I thought, yeah, I've got to write something about this.
The idea of the way you've written it being unusual is that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that it is not solely a Trump bashing book, and you're looking at it, but you're looking at the opportunity in this country. You're looking at your personal experience, and you're putting that into a context of then what you were up against as a member of the administration.
Exactly. I mean, it's sort of three books in one. It's a personal story, story of myself, my family, the things that I've observed, and the way that people lose opportunities, they become disaffected, alienated, you know, from the rest of society on a socioeconomic basis. They sort of see no hope. Educational opportunities are missing. You know, they feel a lack of connection with political elites and elites in the private sector. Everybody that they see in the public facing enterprise of the larger society seems just totally disconnected from them, has no idea, you know, what they're going through. And, you know, many then become susceptible to populist politicians or, you know, kind of quick fixes to their problems, like voting to leave the EU or voting for someone like Trump, who said he would make America great again. So there's that sort of personal experience of that. There's a larger, you know, sort of story of populism. Then there's my experiences in the Trump administration as an example of, you know, this larger story I'm telling. And then there's the public policy aspect of it. I'm at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and already I, you know, mentioned I'd been surprised by how many of my colleagues who were experts on socioeconomic issues, demographic change, economic change in the United States, just not seen any of this coming. You know, and I wanted to lay that all out and weave it together.
You say when I was 13 that I became aware that there was a working class and that I was in it. So at what point through your adolescence did you start to think of what you wanted to do, of what the opportunities actually were for you and what the possibilities were for what you could achieve as a young adult?
Well, there was also kind of a difference in, you know, gender expectations there as well, Joe. I mean, I think you grew up in Massachusetts?
I actually grew up in, well, I grew up in Philadelphia, outside of Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia,
yeah.
Okay. So, you know, a similar place to, you know, the kind of Northeast Corridor then, I mean, Pennsylvania, you know, kind of Massachusetts. I mean, all of those you know, states in the United States were going through similar convulsions to the Northeast of England, the Northeast Corridor back in the sort of 70s and 80s with the, you know, the closing down of, you know, big industry. Textile, you know, factory steel mills, coal mines, you know, you kind of name it on your side of the pond and, you know, same on mine. And so for, you know, a lot of men, boys, you know, kind of grew up in my area, there was an expectation that they would go and just follow their fathers into whatever, you know, industry that they'd been in. My dad followed his father, his brother, his uncles, his grandfather's uncles into the coal mines. That was what was expected. And the educational opportunities he had were very limited because it was just an expectation that he'd, you know, finish school when he needed to, and then he'd go straight down the mines as he did when he was 14. Obviously, for girls, it was different. You know, you weren't going to go down the mines or into the steelworks. You might go into a textile mill, or there might be in a factory job or a retail job. If you, you know, got an education and you managed to kind of go on through school and go further, my mum had become a nurse. And become a midwife at 16. She went into a training course in nursing. Other family members had gone to teacher training colleges to then, you know, go off to be teachers. So that was kind of the sort of the realm of possibility. But at the same time, when I was growing up, and especially when I was leaving school in the 1980s, again, similar to the United States, there were opportunities to get an education. There were scholarships in the UK, in the United States, Pell Grants for people who were the first generation going to college, which was my case. And in the United Kingdom, if you were from a low income background, and especially if, you know, your family were out of work and, you know, had not been to college, to university before, there were grants from your local education authority, your local government, who would pay for you to get an education. So that immediately gave me a different set of opportunities. My parents had, you know, felt a lot of regret, particularly in the case of my father. They hadn't had a chance to get an education. My dad had actually liked school. He didn't want to go immediately down the mines, but he didn't have a choice in his view. There was another opportunity to do something else. My mum ended up being a nurse, but here I had at my doorstep, at my fingertips, you know, kind of thing, an opportunity to go on with my education and that would be paid for. I didn't really know, you know, exactly how to go about it. But it was there. And so that started to scope out other possibilities, not just, you know, kind of a path to be a nurse or a teacher,
right.
Certainly not to go and follow my father into industry. But, you know, as a girl, you know, suddenly actually there was a sense that, yeah, look, you, as they said in the north of England, you're a clever lass. There were some women in my extended family who were, you know, years older than me, you know, almost even another generation, who had gone to something called grammar school where they'd, you know, had their education paid for, which was on a more academic track, and had gone on to college in the larger extended family and, you know, had gone on to do different things. And so, you know, I was actually told, hey, you could do this. There's nothing to stop you because that opportunity's there.
You write in the book that there were women who made it in some form of politics. Of course, the best example being Margaret Thatcher, who you say was not a role model for young women in the north of England, despite her intellectual and political skill and her evident accomplishments. You also say in that section of the book that several factors in the 1980s, not gender, shaped your decision to try to study Russian at university. What was it about Russia that you wanted to explore?
Well, partly I had some early exposure to Russian culture and novels and literature. You know, I'd found a copy of War and Peace in a jumble sale, a secondhand sale. Bought it for, very little money. And I'd started to kind of read it. You know, I'd obviously heard that there was this novel out there, War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And I found it really captivating. It was, huge. But the story that he was telling, was really a very compelling one. And, it had been really well translated into English. And so, I had some exposure to Russian literature, some of the other cultural issues. But it was really the time. Again, you're saying you and I are around the similar age, and in the 1980s, the Soviet Union and the United States were in a standoff, a major confrontation over the stationing of nuclear weapons in Europe, intermediate nuclear missiles. The Soviet Union was stationing SS-20 missiles in Eastern Europe. The United States was stationing Pershing missiles in Western Europe, including in the United Kingdom. And the whole popular culture then in Europe was filled with the idea of a nuclear Armageddon. Maybe an inadvertent or purposeful nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States that would hit Europe, not the United States. So, although in the United States was also great fear of nuclear war, in the 1980s in Europe, this was just palpable. All the political culture, all the songs of the time, the films, the books, it was all about, the day after nuclear Armageddon and we'd all be toast, essentially, or living in a, nuclear winter, the ultimate climate change. And as a kid, they would send out these public service announcements to schools. These were on, real films. It wasn't on the television or the radio warning us about the risk of a missile strike and what we should do in the case of one. And my sister and I used to kind of try to figure out what we would do if we were caught in the open during a missile strike and where would we throw ourselves in a ditch somewhere, which was one of the recommendations. So my whole childhood was, kind of marred in my teenage years by this idea of nuclear war. And at the recommendation of, one of my father's relatives who had fought during World War II and couldn't understand, why the Soviet Union was trying to blow us up. And I had other relatives who were in the campaign for nuclear disarmament out there, protesting all of this. I thought, well, I'll go and study Russian. And maybe I could become an interpreter and, maybe I could somehow help out at some arms control negotiation. It was kind of naive, but, if I had the opportunity to go to university, it was going to be paid for. I could study Russian and do something. It's, that naivety, but also one driven by fear, in your teenage years that propelled me toward it. And it was 1984 when I started studying Russian. So the Soviet Union was omnipresent in many ways. George Orwell's novel of 1984, Big Brother Watching You, all of this was swirling around.
I was going to say, not only with the decision to study this, but as this is happening, you have Reaganism, you have Thatcherism, and you have the collapse of the Soviet Union. So all of this you are watching and studying and really have a front row seat for, which has to have a real impact on how you feel and what you want to do with your life.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about timing, isn't it? I mean, I think, an awful lot of people, as we know, in the United States were really affected, I mean, myself included, by 9/11. I mean, that was one of the precipitating factors for me becoming a citizen and wanting to serve the country and to do something. So many people's lives are changed by these big events that they are part of. I mean, all of us are part of history all the time. We just sometimes just don't quite realize it, that, we're part of all of this. We're not just bystanders. And in the case of all these issues that you described, I got the scholarship to go to study in Moscow in 1987. And then there, when Gorbachev and Reagan signed the INF Treaty that ends this 10-year period of standoff confrontation over intermediate nuclear forces, I'm there for the Gorbachev-Reagan summit in Moscow in the summer of 1988. I get a job as a string BC News. So I get to see all these people close up at first hand. I mean, I'm not doing anything particularly exciting, but I'm there, kind of just part of all of this. And then I come to the United States on a scholarship to Harvard in 1989 that I've learned about these scholarship opportunities while I'm in Moscow in that summer of 1988. And I get there just as the Berlin Wall falls, and I'm studying, you know, these very issues at the time when everything is changing. And yeah, it does have an amazing impact on you. And, you know, weirdly, I, you know, chose to study Russian in 1984, and I'm still doing it now. It's quite rare in many respects for people still to be able to be working in the field that they started off in, you know, so many years ago, because everything changes so much. And so, you know, in many respects, I've had a bit of a wild ride on the Russia front by choosing this area of study, you know, because of the motivation of the times and a mixture of naivety and, you know, interest. I'm still doing this, you know, many years on.
Fiona Hill is our guest. The name of the new book is There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. So as you're watching all that and as you are studying, Mikhail Gorbachev ultimately is displaced by President Boris Yeltsin. And you talk about how there is this economic reform program called shock therapy, and you have a chapter on this. But this is when things start to change in Russia, and you see this, and it from my reading of the book, you have great, great concerns about what's going on.
I do. And, you know, what I started to see in Russia in this period of the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union is very reminiscent of my personal, you know, childhood experiences in the north of England, you know, where things didn't turn out very well either. You get, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of Soviet industry, you know, basically the Soviet Union is one giant blue-collar, you know, working-class society. Loads of people lose their jobs and their livelihoods all at once. A lot of the factories, I mean, keep people on the payroll, but they can't pay them because, you know, the bottom's fallen out of the economy and industries are bartering among themselves to sort of keep production going. You get everything from nuclear engineers to, you know, all the white-collar managers of factories out on the streets trying to, you know, drive cabs to make a living, or selling their household goods or cigarettes in kiosks. You know, you name it, the whole place has been turned on its head. And although Russia in the 1990s is going through this experimentation with democracy and pluralism, and, you know, it's more exciting in many respects than it's ever been before, at the same time, a lot of people are getting very disaffected by the chaos and not very therapeutic. And so by the end of the 1990s, people are looking for something else. Boris Yeltsin's approval ratings are in single digits, and, you know, the whole expansion democracy has become discredited. And then Vladimir Putin comes along, somebody who's been a KGB agent, who's appointed by Yeltsin to take over. He runs a political campaign ostensibly to, you know, be elected formally the president, but he's essentially been chosen. And he was chosen because the people around Yeltsin thought that they could manipulate the guy. You know, it really was a way of them exerting power. And it was also a way of protecting them, as it stripped off some of the assets from the Russian state and, you know, made small fortunes and stashed them away. And, of course, it turns out very differently. Putin says he's going to come back and make Russia great again. He pays off all the debts. You know, he does turn the economy around. But he also turns the politics around and puts Russia back in a more authoritarian direction. The United Kingdom was kind of imploding on itself, you know, the rise of Scottish nationalism, the troubles in Northern Ireland, Welsh nationalism. You know, the United Kingdom was pulling apart as well. And, you know, Margaret Thatcher was, you know, something of a strong centralist ruler, but this also becomes a kind of a more interest in populist extreme parties there too. And what concerns me the most is then later, you know, which is the later part of the book, is how I see that start to play out in the United States on a different timescale, but in a very similar fashion.
And that fashion ultimately is the backlash, right? I mean, we think of Trumpism as a backlash to the Obama administration. We think of Yeltsin and Putin as a backlash to Gorbachev. We think of Boris Johnson as a backlash to the previous administration. Is that fair that we see those strands?
Yeah, there was definitely some backlash to previous, policies and previous political leaders, you know, no question about it. But there's also this feeding off the kind of grievances of the disaffected, the people who feel forgotten. You know, I talk in the book about forgotten people and forgotten right. places. You know, in the Northeast Corridor, you know, for example, where I arrived in Cambridge, Mass, and, you know, you growing up in, Philadelphia, and you think about, you know, kind of what happened to heavy industry and to the people who worked in those mass manufacturing sites up and down the Northeast Corridor. A lot of them did get left behind. I mean, they got new jobs. The Northeast, you know, part of the United States bounced back. New technologies were introduced, new service industries grew up, new parts of the economy, more innovative, but not everywhere, right? I mean, there were still some of the old textile towns of Massachusetts, the old mining, you know, areas of Pennsylvania and the old place of the steelworks that have had a hard time. And that's, you know, kind of part of the problem, because it's there that, you know, people have been looking for something else. They've felt very dissatisfied with the mainstream parties. Their sense of a kind of a backlash to, you know, previous administrations or previous political leaders is very acute. And they're looking for change. And some of that change might mean even just sort of dismantling the system around them. They don't like the fast pace in which the demography of the country or the politics and the economy are changing, and they feel like they can't keep up with it. They want it to stop, and they want things to be turned back, and they want to have their previous places in society restored. So there's all of those elements. Putin in Russia was a restorationist. He said, I'm going to put it back. I'm going to put things back for you. He played a lot upon Imperial Russian and Soviet Russian nostalgia. I mean, not for the Communist Party, sometimes for the czars of Russia, but, you know, very much this sort of nostalgia, you had it better in the past. And that's, you know, what we've seen Trump do in the United States, and Boris Johnson, you know, very much doing that in the UK, talking about a global Britain of a golden age of Imperial Britain, you know, that stood, you know, ruled the waves, as, you know, the Rule Britannia, you know, kind of song goes. An idea of a kind of Britain that was lost but that needs to kind of come back again. And none of these are really looking forward to the very complicated future that we have ahead of us. You're looking back all the time to a golden age, a silver age that you want to kind of restore.
Fiona Hill is our guest on the roundtable. The name of the new book is There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. The book is published by Mariner. We will take a quick break and continue our conversation with Fiona Hill right after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Fiona Hill is our guest. The new book is There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. Fiona Hill is the Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. From 2017 to 2019, she served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council. So let's talk about your time at the White House. It is the second half of the book. You talked early on in our first part about there were some of your colleagues that were wincing. What did you think initially you would be able to accomplish by taking the role that you did?
Well, initially, I thought that the outcome of the election in 2016, I mean, this was a major coup for the Russians. They'd done these influences operations all the way along, you know, through the Cold War, but succeeded like this in grabbing so much attention because, you know, they were able to avail themselves of the new tools of social media.
So at the time you take this role at the White House, I mean, the Russians feel that they're in a really good position here then.
Absolutely. The Russians think that they've had the biggest success for one of their influences, influence operations that they ever could have envisaged, even going back to the Cold War when they put on all these efforts to try to mess about in our elections or and in our politics. Because, you know, they found such a fertile ground for this sophisticated operation, mixture of propaganda, but also using social media. And they were able to very effectively play Americans' divisions off against each other. So what I thought I was going to do was go into the administration with people that I'd worked with previously when I'd been National Intelligence Officer. We were going to try to push back against this, you know, try to, across the government, you know, come up with a strategy for mitigating the fallout from this and, you know, trying to make sure that they couldn't do this again. And I assumed that, you know, most people would see the national security crisis that we had on hand and would rise to the occasion despite all of the political rhetoric around the campaign and around the elections that, you know, when push came to shove and people were actually in their positions, they would be motivated to do something. I discovered that that was not the case. And obviously there were other games afoot, not just, you know, what was going on, you know, with Russian operatives, but our own domestic political operatives who had their own agendas that had nothing to do with national security. And in fact, you know, there was a lot of people privatizing foreign policy and national security in the United States and were not really concerned at all about, you know, the Russians were doing. That for them was, you know, just a sort of a marginal issue.
You write in the book that although President Trump was accused of being in the employ of the Russian president, the truth is that he simply wanted to emulate him. Neither one is good, though, right?
No. I mean, you know, this is not exactly, you know, a kind of great alternative theory or conclusion here. The manipulation, no matter how it is orchestrated by blackmail or having, you know, some kind of, you know, dirt or, you know, something compelling, you know, piece of information that you can then force someone to collude with you, is, you know, no better in its outcome, you know, or, you know, no worse than its outcome, depending on how well we're trying to articulate this here, than, you know, basically my conclusion that President Trump was so susceptible to flattery and to, you know, basically persuasion that he could be induced to do all things. I mean, there is a term in, you know, people use about a useful idiot, a fellow traveler, you know, someone who is an unwitting accomplice to things. And, you know, that would apply to President Trump.
You make the point, and I find this fascinating. I mean, I know much has been written about this, but I find this fascinating, especially from your perspective. You write that he seemed to look up to Putin because of his wealth, and he admired how Putin ran Russia like his own private company. He came to resemble Putin more than he wanted to resemble any of his predecessors in that job as president of the United States.
Absolutely right. Look, he kept referring to every single president who'd gone before him as an idiot. I mean, he openly said that. He thought they were stupid. He thought their policies were ineffective. He was basically kind of saying that, you know, only he could fix the problems that they'd all left behind, even historical figures. He was always equivocating on Reagan and, you know, who left the scene by then, and Lincoln. I mean, you know, often at different points, even the kind of the great figures from his, ostensibly his own party, he would disparage in some way or, you know, damn with faint praise. So his view was that he was a unique American president. He was more like the strong man around on the international stage. And he saw his peer group not as his predecessors, but as people like Vladimir Putin, President Xi of China, President Erdogan of Turkey. It wasn't about their countries, it's about what they stood for. He was also pretty fixated on Queen Elizabeth II of the United Kingdom. Not because, of course, she has unrivaled political power. I mean, we know she does not as a constitutional monarch. It's very circumscribed, but she has celebrity, staying power, great respect, admiration, adulation, you know, depending on, you know, who you're looking at. And basically, Trump wanted to be a combination of all of those individuals.
One of the things that you talk about is that, and I think this is important to point out, you had worked three different presidential administrations you've been a part of. And in that experience, and I, of course, this is said by many people who've been a part of the Trump administration, but you will add to the chorus that nothing could have ever prepared you for what you were about to walk into.
Well, exactly. You know, there, you know, were plenty of warning signs. A lot of people who knew Trump and the way that he operated in his business in New York, you know, I think a lot of them, you know, were quite aware of how he conducted himself and not at all surprised. But I think there was an expectation from many, and, you know, myself included, actually, that being in the office of the president with, you know, the whole, you know, weight of the U.S. government around him would, you know, kind of force some changes in, you know, his conduct and the whole way that he presented himself and, you know, even his rhetoric. And, of course, that didn't happen. And I realized that, you know, pretty quickly myself, probably in the first, you know, couple of days, certainly my first encounters with him, that, okay, you know, he was not going to be as presidential as he was going to claim he was going to be you know, during the campaign and when he got elected, he was still going to be himself, the celebrity businessman who was going to basically run the country like his own family business. And that was evident because my very first encounter with Trump in the Oval Office, Ivanka Trump, his daughter, comes in, you know, immediately. And it's very clear this is a family affair. I mean, the fact that his close family members had official positions in the White House, you know, people go back to the Kennedys and talk about JFK and Robert Kennedy as his attorney general. I mean, that was also inappropriate. But this was, you know, kind of new realms of inappropriate, irrespective of whether they were being paid or not. His most important counsel, his information was coming from close family members and people who had been working with him in Trump Enterprises. I mean, he essentially sees the country as, you know, kind of merged and acquired by, you know, the Trump business. And it's just, you know, basically another version of Trump family firm, but with, you know, the military and, you know, kind of all the trappings of a superpower attached.
At what point did you realize, because obviously, as I said, nothing could have prepared you for walking into this. This is highly unorthodox. This is not the way previous administrations had worked. And then as you start to see what is going on, that you realize that there's real trouble here and someone needs to say something.
Well, there was plenty of people saying things internally, you know, kind of raising alarms about things, trying to push back. You know, many of the people who did, you obviously got ousted, many resigned. I mean, the real, I think, importance and imperative to stand up came during the impeachment trial. You know, when I knew that I would be, you know, called to testify and subpoenaed, there was no question that I was going to stand up and tell people that I might believe in representational democracy, in the authority of the Congress to, you know, hold these hearings, to have oversight over the executive branches, the checks and balances in the system. I hadn't entered the administration to serve Trump as an individual. I'd entered in to serve the country, to try to do something on national security. I had this big portfolio, and I'd seen over and over again how it was being perverted by people for their own personal private interests. And I'd already, you know, as I was leaving the National Security Council a week or so before this fateful phone call, I'd already basically expressed all my concerns about it. I'd filled in all of my other colleagues. And, you know, once I knew that this call had taken place, like everybody else did, and saw the transcript, there was just no question that I was, you know, going to do the right thing and hold up my oath of office, my oath to the Constitution, and, you know, basically testify.
When that happens, you obviously become a devil to those on the right. You are called a Soros mole. You're called a lot of things that are really horrible, but you are featured on InfoWars by Alex Jones. Roger Stone is involved. You are made out to be the enemy. Sometimes you're watching all of this around you and you sort of look around the room thinking to yourself, okay, who understands what's going on here?
Well, look, I mean, you know, my understanding of this was, hey, we just became the Soviet Union during the Stalinist purges, when people made stuff up about their neighbors because, you know, they wanted their neighbor's apartment, or they might have wanted their neighbor's wife or their neighbor's wife's fur coat. They went around denouncing people and, you know, kind of whipping up show trials, using conspiracy theories to threaten people. I'm sorry, I've seen that movie before. And, you know, maybe these guys, you know, don't realize what they're doing, but I do. And I'd lived in the Soviet Union. I was there from 1987 to 1988 when it was still a full surveillance state. And, you know, kind of modern Russia has gone down that path as well, you know, poisoning and, you know, trying to assassinate and in fact succeeding with opposition figures sticking, you know, poison in someone's underpants. You know, there's a Yuri Alexei Navalny shooting, you know, Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov on the bridge in front of the Kremlin. You know, I've been studying a place where people play dirty all the time. And guess what? We've been doing the same. So, you know, that is to me appalling because, I mean, I came to the United States in 1989. So at the end of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall came down, you know, while I was here. The United States was a beacon of hope, you know, stood up for the truth and justice and fairness around the world. It had intervened in two world wars and pushed back against Nazism and fascism and the communist, Soviet Union, and against, these kinds of atrocities in other places. And we're doing the same. I'm going to shout up against this. So what is next, the gulag? That was kind of what I was looking at this and thinking, really? These people can't even see who they are and what they've become. It made me angry. I'll be frank.
Well, no.
To make everybody angry as an American citizen. We're becoming the Soviet Union, and these guys are accusing anybody who stands up and speaks the truth of being a Marxist, a communist, a socialist, a this, a that, or the other, putting labels all over people to shut them up. Well, I'm not going to shut up, because that's how other countries lost their way.
So the question I asked, and it's one that I'm curious about, is was there a guiding hand there? Did you have allies as you were going through what you were going through, even within the administration?
Well, I certainly had an awful lot of other people who were doing their jobs. There were many people who testified as fact witnesses, right? Most people, will look back and remember Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, whose family brought him and his brothers to the United States when they were children from the Soviet Union for another life, having been persecuted, there also as Jews in the Soviet Union, where, there was massive discrimination. There was also Maria Yovanovitch, Ambassador Maria Yovanovitch, right. Our ambassador to Ukraine, who had also come from over from the Eastern Bloc as a child and, brought for a different life here, and also his family's been, communism and repression. All of the people who came forward to speak out, to testify, the people speaking out, the people who filed the whistleblower complaints, all of the people who were standing up and still trying to conduct U.S. policy, both on the domestic and foreign policy front, they were all doing the same thing that I was. Exactly the same thing. So, the public servants out there, all the people that we know about now in the Department of Justice who are pushing back against what Trump was trying to do, the people in the uniformed military, people into the Defense Department, there were so many people who were trying to push back against this perversion of American democracy.
And yet we still had January 6th and a coup attempt. And you write about this in the book of how he tried to stay in power by following in the footsteps of autocrats, of whether it be Napoleon or Maduro. I'm interested in how the you look at the ineffectual response to that and think to yourself, okay, and you say this, that it's not hard to believe that whoever that next populist is will probably succeed where Trump failed.
Yeah, and it could be Trump again, okay?
Right.
I admit it, he's still there. He wants to come back. He says he's never left, that he's just been, forced into temporary exile. He has people now, going out on his behalf, basically trying to push back against independent election monitors, the secretaries of state or the state secretaries in places around the country where there's been contested elections. He's already laying the groundwork to push back against any electoral outcome in 2024 that's not him, in all of the kind of key swing states. People trying to repress the vote, restrict voting rights, you name it. This is all more competence because he's got groups of people around him now who they want that power back again. And there are many people who would like to, pick up his mantle of being president that are joining him in these same exercises to ensure that they can seize power. So there might be more competence the next time around. And, for sure, if Trump gets back in, there will be a lot of vengeance against the establishment, the public servants in the state that, tried to push back against him. And I would be confident that he would try to govern the country again or rule the country, in his mind, completely out of the White House with loyalists, getting rid of, all of the public servants who were independent across the government.
You say that losing the opportunity gap is the only long-term solution to this long-term challenge.
This is a multifaceted challenge. Obviously, we'll take people at the top in Congress up and deciding that they don't want to throw American democracy down the drain, and maybe that they're Americans first rather than, members of some charismatic, personality cult. That's essentially what this has become around President Trump right now, and that they actually remember that they're supposed to be serving their constituents, American people, and, standing up for the defense of our democracy and political system. So it'll take that. But also, I think it's going to take a collective effort by all of us at the community, the neighborhood, the state and local government level to pull together, you know, to try to reach out to the people who are feeling disaffected, both socioeconomically and also politically, and feeling alienated. We have to bring back that sense of community, that sense of being Americans and all in a shared endeavor here. I mean, that's why I came to the United States. I wanted to be an American. I wanted to be an American citizen. I didn't want to divide myself off into these weird identities of being a red American or a blue American. That's not what America's about. And, you know, that's, I think, the sentiment of the vast majority of Americans, if you ask them. I mean, they want to have opportunities. They want their kids to get educated. They want to have a better life than they had for their children and grandchildren. You know, they want to see the United States competitive in the world and, you know, the economy flourishing. It's a kind of a public-private sector, all hands on deck endeavor. And in the book, I do lay out a few suggestions for, you know, things that we could all do. We all have agency. There are 330 million of us, not just one man.
You make an interesting point in the book when you're talking about President Biden's Build Back Better program, which you say certainly is a step in the right direction. But you also make, I think, a nuanced point that we should not return America to its prior state, that what we really need to do is build forward together.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, my own version of the same slogan, but we have to be looking forward rather than back. Because an awful lot of the industries that we've had in the past are not going to come back. That's my personal experience. You know, when the coal mines closed down, the steelworks and the shipyards back at home in the northeast of England, they didn't come back. New industries came, you know, some variation of the original industries. I mean, actually, the steel sector, you know, has kind of moved into a different phase with innovation and, you know, new developments. There's automation, you know, there's new manufacturing techniques. But that's the whole point. It's all new. And we have to basically figure out how our society, you know, how our public policy is structured for what's ahead, not what was behind us. We've got climate change we're going to have to contend with. We're still in the throes of a horrible pandemic that's going to have had, you know, massive effects on our economy and our society and on the structure of kind of global trade and economy. We're seeing all the effects of this already now, in the supply and distribution breakdowns and an energy crisis. You know, we're going to have to tackle all of this. And so we have to really take a long, hard look about what we need to deal with an unpredictable and fast-changing future, not go back, you know, to the things that we had before, because the ways that we did things before, you know, may not be at all suited. You know, we've got a lot of problems with places in the United States may become uninhabitable, some of our major centers of population. You know, up and down the East Coast in areas that have become, you know, stricken by drought, hit by hurricanes over and over again. You know, we may have to do things dramatically differently from what we did in the past.
After leaving the administration and returning to whatever normal could be, because yeah, obviously it affects you greatly and there's an impact that it has on you, but does it further the resolve of the work that you have done, the continued work, or does it maybe put you even in a new path or a new direction?
You know, all of the things that we're grappling with have become the fodder for external actors to take advantage of. It's not just our own domestic political system that's set up to have people, you know, use whatever they can against their political opponents, but our external opponents can do the same thing. And we need to heal those divisions as a way of blunting the impact of, you know, external influence operations. So we can't do one without the other. And so I'm more concerned at this particular point about the future of the United States. You know, we've got to figure out how we regulate the internet and social media platforms, because that's what has been exploited by Russians and others. So it's not so much about, you know, Russia here. It's about fixing ourselves at this particular point. There's, you know, a lot we have to do on preventing dirty money, you know, foreign money from sloshing around in our system and having influence. You know, there's these revelations by investigative journalists about the Pandora Papers and shell companies being built up across the United States that have become havens for illicit finance in places like South Dakota, of all places, not just, you know, all the places we normally associate with that kind of activity. We've got to clean that up. So we've got to clean up our act, and it'll then make it much more difficult for Russia, China, you know, Iran, North Korea, I mean, you name it, then to basically mess around in our systems if we've got them, you know, shored up internally. So, you know, if that's a new path, then yes. I mean, I'd like to do more on that kind of front in the future than, you know, I have previously, because that's where some of the national security dilemmas are now focused.
Fiona Hill is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Her new book is There Is Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. The book is published by Mariner. Fiona Hill, a great pleasure and honor to have you on our program. I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Likewise, Joe. I'm so pleased to be with you. Thank you so much.
Be well. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
again, the name of the book is There Is Nothing for You Here by Fiona Hill. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.